The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Mike Sachs. Mike Sachs is the author of many books, including And Here's the Kicker, an incredible collection of conversations with comedy writers such as Harold Ramis, David Sedaris, and Buck Henry. His follow-up to that, Poking a Dead Frog, is equally terrific, as it features interviews with Adam McKay, Mel Brooks, Daniel Klaus, and more. Mike's collection of humor pieces, Your Wildest Dreams Within Reason, was published in 2011, and he co-edited the book Care to Make Love in That Gross Little Space Between Cars. He has written for The New Yorker, Vice, The Believer, and he's on the editorial staff of Vanity Fair. You can hear Mike on his podcast, Doing It with Mike Sachs. Mike, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
Thanks for having me.
So, since both of us have spent so much of our adult lives immersed in comedy and in conversation with comedy writers and performers, I was looking for some unifying theme to kick off our conversation. So, I actually found myself online looking at the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. I don't know what rabbit hole I went down that got me there, but it did. And I read the following, and there's a quote. Couples listing the traits they prize in their spouses usually put sense of humor at or near the top. Philosophers are concerned with what is important in life, so two things are surprising about what they have said about humor. The first is how little they have said. The second is how negative they have been in their assessment of humor.
That's interesting. I never heard that relationship. I would think that they would have a positive attitude towards humor, but yeah, I never heard of that before. I wonder why that is.
I understand why they aren't talking about it in some regards. The second actually did ring a bell because I started thinking back of sort of Freud stuff on humor and sort of, you know, historically the idea that perhaps it was vulgar, right? And, you know, my thought was, this is what ran through my head, which is at a certain point they figured out that sex is so important that it actually ended up in the science field and that maybe we're just getting to that place with comedy, that comedy is coming after sex.
Well, I don't know. I mean, now that I'm thinking about it, I do feel that most comedy writers and comedians in comedy feel they're agnostic, meaning that they don't understand why we're here and they feel that we're not capable of understanding why we're here. So why not just laugh? Where philosophers are looking for an answer. I think most comedy writers sort of know that this is the best it gets, and even if it has to do with death, you can still laugh at it. You'll laugh your way through it.
Yeah, I think you're generally right with the people I've worked with at Second City is that it's that, you know, it's such a painful existence that it's much better to approach it with humor. There are the few activists who come through. I think Adam McKay was certainly one of those who came through Second City, but you know, he'd be an outlier. Most of them aren't.
What do you mean by an activist as far as political?
Yeah. Adam wanted his work to change the world. That was something. But equally, he was interested in doing stupid funny. We actually screened one of his shows last week, Pinata Full of Bees, that he did that I produced.
Oh, yeah.
In 1995, and that was, I mean, he was going to rallies. He was there was a big strike down in Joliet that I was reminded that we all went to because he really wanted his comedy to make a difference.
Well, I don't think necessarily most comedians, comedy writers, don't want to make a difference. I think if they didn't want to make a difference, they wouldn't do what they do. I think they smell the shit more clearly, and a lot bothers them. And by talking about it through jokes and humor, I think it's more forward-thinking than not doing anything. But I think you're right about being on the front lines. Adam's one of the rare ones. I think most of those in comedy, most people in comedy would rather let their humor do the talking rather than going out on picket lines or being on the front lines of our own political issues.
Yeah, and I when I was reading, and here's the kicker, there was a great line that Buck Henry said, which is, with comedy, you deflect danger, you cover up emotion, you engage your enemy without getting your face smashed in.
Right, and you have to be intelligent to be able to do that. If we were capable of beating shit out of people, I think we would do that. But we were always the ones in the back of the class, you know, creatively mocking those who were better than us.
Right, and one of the interesting things about that to me, in terms of it's the concept of distance, right? So you've got sort of, that's a thing in comedy. I mean, a lot of comedy works because of its distance, where you're not the one getting your face smashed in. You're on the outside of that.
Yeah, you have to be wily. I mean, I think everyone in comedy, maybe not everyone, most people in comedy were on the outside looking in.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it was, you know, whether they were home alone on prom night watching Monty Python, or whether they were not invited to the parties, or whether they weren't athletes, or whether it's straight A people, they, you know, they're on the outside. But I think if anyone, and through humor and creativity, but I think if anyone was in that group, was in the popular group, was in the pop fraternity, I don't know anyone who has then devoted their lives to comedy. I mean, it's an outsider sensibility.
Yeah, completely. It's kind of amazing because at Second City, we get brought in by many, many businesses to help facilitate difficult conversations. So like mergers or rebrands or downsizing. And so what we're doing is using comedy as a way to call out the elephant in the room without actually blowing up the room. But they are taking advantage of our outsider status to be able to speak a little bit of truth to power. And I think that's actually a cool thing. It's you know, we maintain our distance, but, you know, we're invited into the party every now and again.
Well, I think it's a great thing. And the fact that they're going to those people who aren't in that group to ask advice, seek advice, I think is an interesting thing, where it's a valuable thing to know how to do. And, you know, a lot of people in comedy were forced to learn how to do it,
right,
in order to survive. I don't think if they had their druthers, they would be home alone. Maybe I'm just speaking to myself, watching or reading comedy. I think they would be out socializing. And the fact that we sort of, this is all self-taught, sort of is impressive to me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I was certainly that kid as well, because, you know, I remember the lineup on PBS in terms of watching Python, the two Ronnies, Dave Allen at Large, right? So that committed to memory was not being out, but being in and digging that stuff.
Right. So if you had a girlfriend, if you had a group of great friends that you were out at the beach or the lakefront, what would you have chosen to do? Stay home and watch comedy, or go out and have fun?
No, go out and have fun. So comedy.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a line I often use, which is, no one got into comedy because they're well adjusted.
No, definitely not. In fact, just the opposite.
Yep. So one of the great joys of working at Second City for so many years is the unexpected conversations you get into with your idols. And Harold Ramis was someone who is always completely generous in making himself available to you, and I often cite him as someone who is an extremely effective leader, albeit a kind of sublime and quiet leader. In your interview with Harold Ramis, he says, "My job is not to force the actor to do anything. It's to convince them." And I think that's an important distinction.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when he talks about Groundhog Day and the difficulty he had working with Bill Murray,
mm-hmm.
A lot of that came through his frustration of Bill Murray not listening. I mean, Bill Murray literally wouldn't call him back, but Harold Ramis, being the type of person he was, he had the larger idea of pushing this movie forward and making it as good as it could get. I think most directors would have produced something not nearly as good as what he did. I think it was his philosophy, and he's a very philosophical guy, that made that movie, as well as other movies, really stand out.
And interesting that I would say that's one of his best films, and yeah, it was a difficult process. That was not fun for anyone.
No, I mean, he was dealing with a screenwriter who came in with an original script where the action had already been taking place for, I think, 2,000 years. So he switched that around, and there was some difficulty with that. And then there was difficulty in dealing with someone as brilliant but as you know, kind of prickly as Bill Murray.
Yeah.
But the fact that he could pull that off, I think, just shows you how, you know, philosophical he was and how intelligent he was and not just with comedy, but in life and even religious.
Yep.
I mean, that's a very religious movie, Groundhog Day. Every religious person can see their own religion in that, whether you're Buddhist, Jewish, Christian, or whatever. It's a very interesting movie in that sense. As a comedy, I don't know of anything else that's similar to it.
No, that's a really good point. And Trevor Albert, who is a longtime collaborator, producer of that film, was in town recently and said that all these people sort of claim it for their religion. He doesn't stop any of them because it really is open to all that interpretation. I get the sense that Paul Feig, and I think I'm saying his name right, from Freaks and Geeks.
Paul Feig,
that he also had a similar sensibility. And I don't know that because I don't know him, but you interviewed him.
I love Paul Feig. He's one of those people who I think really kind of changed comedy. I mean, before being nerd was cool, he was nerdy, and he came up with that pre-internet. And that being nerdy pre-internet is a lot different than being nerdy post-internet.
For sure. Yeah.
That really affected him. He's a very decent person, a very nice person, open person. And you can see that in his comedy, the fact that he would write about so-called, geeks, freaks and geeks, that they were so true to life. These were people that he actually knew. You know, usually with writers, even if they were a geek, they don't manage to capture it because they're perhaps still looking down their nose at the so-called geeks or those who are a little bit different. But he never did, even with the hermaphrodite character in one of the episodes of Freaks and Geeks. That was handled very, very well. And I think and how he deals, too, with female comedy,
right?
I thought was an amazing thing. He's just a very genuine, decent person, and I love the guy. I think his comedy is just amazing.
Yeah, when you interviewed him, he said, what I do know is that people in the Midwest seem to be a little more emotionally honest. Maybe their bullshit meter is higher, and I think that the Midwestern sense of humor is about honesty and realism. That strikes true for me.
Yeah, I was just interviewing Brian Stack, who's a writer for now Colbert. He used to be Conan. He's from outside Chicago.
Second City alum.
Yeah.
Yep.
Another great guy.
Totally.
Just a very decent guy, and that comes through in his humor. And he was describing to me, because I'm not that familiar with the Midwest, that type of humor. And it interests me because the honesty and the truthfulness, even with fictional characters that he forms or the characters that Paul Feig creates, every one of those characters are truthful and honest and no BS. And I like that, even if there's not likable in the traditional sense. They're likable to me because they're true to life.
Yeah. Mark Maron was hanging out at the theater. This is a couple years ago. We got into an interesting conversation because he was looking at all the photos on the wall at Second City, right? And so this goes back to 1959. And one of the things that he noticed is, you have what at a certain point was everyone's perception of the quintessential Second City person, who really was the quintessential comedy person, the John Belushis and the Bill Murrays and the Chris Farleys, sort of wild men. And then he looked at the modern era and he's like, wait, Amy Poehler, Tina Fey, Stephen Colbert, Steve Carell, those are all like actually nice, well-actualized people. And he's right. They actually are.
Absolutely. I mean, Stephen Colbert is one of the most genuine people out there.
Yep.
And I've been thinking about that, too. I wonder why that is the case and why it's different. And I think part of it is that the past, becoming a comedian, becoming a comic writer, was sort of like joining the circus. You had to go off the path. But it's become more mainstream, and I think either it attracts people who are more centered or the people who go into it don't feel they have to act like they would in a rock and roll show or feel they have to be John Belushi.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. The other thing, because I was thinking about this, is status is such a huge thing in comedy. And very simply for people, you think about Abbott and Costello, right? You think about high status, low status, Laurel and Hardy. It's very clean. And anyone who's studying comedy, whether it's stand-up or improvisation, has to get their arms around status. And your interview with Alison Silverman, who also studied at Second City, she talks about actually taking notes at Second City shows, identifying various status shifts among characters.
Right.
And that was intriguing to me, especially in light of her work producing Colbert Report, because Stephen's character, while high status, is incredibly vulnerable. And Allison said in the interview, he's a moron, he's not an asshole.
Yeah, and I think there's a big difference. I think even, and we liked that character because he wasn't an asshole, because it was truthful to that character. Yeah, but I think status definitely does play a role in comedy. But, you know, to be funny, you can never be a Trump. You know, you
right.
can be on the outskirts mocking Trump. But status, when it comes to comedy, you always have to be lower than those that you're going after. Otherwise, it's just you're going to be a bully.
Right. You got to punch up. And I think that's the problem that people have gotten themselves in trouble with, especially various radio hosts who call themselves comics, is they end up punching down.
Right. I think you can do it. I think in a satirical sense, if you're mocking someone who's mocking someone who died in the Holocaust, you can do it. But the margin of error is very, very thin. And if you fail, you're going to fail very deeply.
I'm sort of curious in your interview process, because you interview high status folks, and I would say like Bob Odenkirk and Dick Cavett, very high status. And then you have low status folks like Stephen Merchant or Larry Wilmore. Do you actually adjust your style of interview based on the temperament of the person you're talking to?
Oh, definitely. I mean, part of that is the research. And I'll listen to every podcast they've done. Actually, they weren't even podcasts when I was doing the first book. So it was just really reading every interview I could find. And you can sort of sense what they're going to be like. A very few instances, they turned out not to be what I predicted in the negative sense. You know, they were much more difficult than I thought they would be. But most, you can sort of read and sort of predict how they're going to act. But as far as, you know, I wouldn't interview anyone differently because they're more well-known. In fact, I think to get better answers, you have to go after the big names like you would anyone and ask them questions that you know, you're not fearful of asking because they're well-known. The one thing you do have to avoid with well-known people is you cannot ask the same questions that they've been asked a million times, because not only will it annoy them, but you're not going to get a good interview. So it really does come down to a tremendous amount of research for anyone, whether they're at the top or, you know, just starting to emerge.
For sure. So you once worked at The Washington Post, and I take it that that was not an enjoyable experience.
It's terrible.
I found a quote. You said, "I was tired of working with egomaniacs who wore red, white, and blue bow ties, the nerds with attitudes. There is worse type of nerd."
Wow. Yeah, I don't even remember saying it, but I'm from D.C., and I know the Washingtonian, and there's two types of Washingtonians. There's the marble D.C., which is obvious, lawyers, egomaniac, journalists, and then there is the Georgia Avenue D.C., which is more like Fugazi, Discord Records, George Pelicanos. And that's the world I knew. So to go into that egotistical D.C. political world, which never really interested me, was definitely going into a world that I didn't know from, even though I was from that area. And it was something I don't want to do again, quite frankly.
It also strikes me as distinctly unfunny, that place.
Very funny. I mean, very unfunny. I grew up there outside D.C. and Maryland, Virginia, and growing up, it was very much NPR humor, you know, government-sponsored humor. It was Mark Russell. It was the Capitol Steps. And it was just depressing as shit, because this was pre-internet, so I didn't really know of any burgeoning scene. Now, there turned out to be one. Patton Oswalt's from that area, among other great names. But it was very low-key, and there wasn't a sense of community, a comedic community. There was a sense of musical community. But I felt very lonely and very ostracized. I didn't find that type of humor funny. It was a very strange place to grow up, very unfunny. And it's just, like, looking back, you know, with the Mark Russell specials on PBS, you know, I just sought out things talked to me. And usually at that time, it was British and sort of also underground type things, as well as Letterman, Chris Elliott on David Letterman, to be specific. Those are really the only things that I was receiving in that area at that time that sort of spoke and made a connection with me.
Oh, I mean, I am right with you. The the British stuff, which I talked about watching on PBS, and then I specifically remember when Chris Elliott came out as Marlon Brando on Letterman. That to me, I was like, the meta stuff of here is speaking to me in a way that none of my college classes were speaking to me.
Well, I mean, to this day, I've memorized those sketches. Those sketches, and I'm now friends with Adam Resnick, who co-wrote those sketches, and I tell him, and I'm not in any way being facetious, Chris Elliott changed my life. I mean, what he was doing, more so really then than what came later, the scary aspect of the characters is what I always liked. So the guy under the seats and Marlon Brando, those were frightening characters, and I had never quite seen anything like that before. And when he came out as Marlon Brando and would antagonize Letterman, I thought that was the funniest thing I had ever seen. And to this day, that has really been more of an influence on me than any other character or TV show.
I know, and there's a kind of, and I don't know if this is the same for you, but I discovered Chris Elliott, and then I discovered his dad, who was part of the great radio comedy team, Bob and Ray. And my father was in broadcasting for his whole life. He's actually here at WGN for 33 years. But when he was growing up in Boston, Bob and Ray would allow teenagers to come in as a quasi-studio audience. And he would go and sit in on the radio show, which I thought was an amazing thing.
It is an amazing thing. And there's another, I mean, he's now deceased, but he was biggest mensch, the sweetest person, the sweetest genius I had ever met. I mean, he was so nice and so modest that you sort of could forget at how brilliant they were. And if you listen to bootleg recordings of Bob and Ray, or even non-bootleg, you can find it out on iTunes, that type of humor is very current, very modern. It has not aged poorly at all. Mm-hmm. I think they were huge forerunners when it came to a sensibility of comedy that influenced an entire generation.
We have a thing at Second City that we do with Columbia College. We have a thing called Comedy Studies, where you can study for a semester and do a deep dive in comedy. And my wife actually teaches it, and she does the history and analysis of modern comedy. And one of the things that I found very interesting is how the kids today don't respond to Preston Sturges, but they love Ernie Kovacs.
Yeah, I was just talking about Ernie Kovacs today with Jason Zinnemann, who's mm-hmm. just written in the new Letterman book, which is coming out in April, which sounds amazing, by the way. But we were both saying that he was very influential, Ernie Kovacs, but he's not that. If you watch it now, I don't find it as funny as Bob and Ray or others from that time. Very influential, but I don't think it's really held up that well.
Yeah, to me, it carries with it some Adult Swim, some Conan. I think that's maybe what the younger people are seeing. Here's another one that's interesting is that Anne has found that women are really responding to Phyllis Diller and her stuff.
Really? Phyllis Diller?
Yeah.
More so than Joan Rivers?
Yes, more so than Joan Rivers.
Why do you think that is?
I think that Phyllis is playing a little more meta. I think that they're recognizing it's a character. I knew Joan Rivers a little bit over the years because she's a Second City alum. And she was always playing in murky waters. I mean, there would be, you know, for every time she would say something sort of brilliant, then, you know, you'd move over and she's doing some schlocky reality TV. And she felt like she was very much caught between legitimate career and illegitimate career. And I think that was her as a person, too. But she had a rough go of it. I get it.
Yeah, she was really paved the way for women comedians. I mean, hugely influential. But I'm surprised that Phyllis Diller would make that much of a connection.
Yeah.
How about the other ones like Belle Barth and those or Rusty Warren? Are they hot to young women?
No, they haven't. When Anne talks to the kids about like their biggest influences, now the women have tons of stuff to choose from, right? So they're all Broad City, they're all Amy Poehler, they're all Amy Schumer. I mean, they're you know, and really, you know, when you start naming those women, they're very little known, and there's that list ain't much longer than that.
Right, and I think that's the type of thing where thankfully that's changed, and I think. Yeah. For those coming up now, like my daughter, who's 7 years old, by the time she's an adult, there'll be so many women in comedy that they can look after. I mean, it's really exploded. And when you look at, it wasn't that long ago when shows or executives didn't want to make comedy shows with women or movies with women. I mean, it almost seems like a ridiculous, absurd thing to have to point out, but it wasn't that long ago. And the fact that it's exploding like it is now is amazing.
Well, I had a front row seat to this because one of the things that's interesting is at Second City Toronto, they almost always had gender equal casts. And you start to look at like, well, okay, who is breaking then? You're like, oh, Gilda Radner, Catherine O'Hara, Andrea Martin, right? It's a nice list. And at Second City, we didn't have our first gender equal cast until a show called Paradigm Lost in 1996. And yes, that was Tina Fey and Rachel Dratch. And then Amy Poehler was in the Turing Company at that time. So you start to look at the timing and it fits, right? So, you know, Tina and Rachel get hired to SNL and then Amy comes in. And then there's those great casts with Maya, and suddenly the women were far more impressive, I think, than the men on SNL, and that was the beginning of that new era.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my favorite performers in the last 25 years are women. The women were, right now, even the current staff, I think my favorite characters are women. What's sad is that the talent existed out there. I just don't think they were given the opportunity.
No, but they got it now. I saw online a few days ago a blogger called your podcast, Doing It with Mike Sacks, the comedy podcast of your wet dreams.
Wow.
Right?
I think so. That sounds familiar. I probably like it. Whenever I see my name, I just like something. I don't even read it. But yeah, that's... Oh, I know who wrote that. Okay. Yeah, it was Stefan. He wrote an article about the podcast, right?
Yeah, I love that. And I mean, while a podcast seems to be a natural extension of the work you're already doing, I do think it's also emblematic of a shift in the comedy industry. So it's no longer acceptable to stay in your lane. It used to be that folks were either comedy writers or performers, or they were directors or maybe producers. But today, it's vital that people entering the industry have the ability to perform in a variety of areas.
Right. Well, that's the great thing about it. I mean, you have to do what you want, how you want to do it. And you shouldn't be catty-cornered into a specific title. If you want to do a podcast, do that. If you want to talk about comedy, that's fine. If you want to write comedy, it's fine. Or if you want to do everything, I think that's fine. I think the opportunity now, which did not exist when I first graduated college, is just astonishing now. I mean, the fact that someone in their bedroom in Illinois can be heard across the world with their views on comedy or their comedy itself, I think it's just unprecedented.
Yeah, completely. I want to talk to you. We're almost coming to the end, which is drag, but I want to talk to you about this. I saw a Larry Gelbart interview that you did, and I was really struck by this idea of autonomy. And here's what Larry Gelbart said. He said, "Some people in Hollywood treat me like I'm a monument. They just want to drive around me and take a closer look, maybe even have our picture taken together. But I'd much rather have less of that type of respect and more of the other kind, the kind where they leave your work alone."
Right. Well, he was, even towards the end, now this is someone who wrote for Bob Hope as a teenager, who wrote for Your Show of Shows, who wrote Tootsie, who created MASH, the TV show. Even he was struggling out in Hollywood as a writer. So he was not really being given the respect he should have been given. And that, to me, was a very important lesson, where if someone like that is not afforded the respect, if someone like S.J. Perlman went out there, James Thurber went out there and struggled, then I'm certainly going to go out there and struggle. But it also comes back to, we don't need anymore to go after 10 executives and please them. You can do what you want to do on your own. It's very punk rock. It's a very garage sensibility. And I kind of wish that Larry Gelbart had lived, you know, another 5-10 years into this position now, where I think he could have written for Hulu or Netflix, or he could have done something that maybe wouldn't have brought in that much money, but he would have had total creative control. And you know what? He deserved that creative control, but he never really did receive it, even towards the end.
Right. I mean, I think about the way that Carl Reiner has embraced social media and kind of taken care of his own narrative in older age, which I absolutely love, and I love what he has to say.
Oh, so do I. And the fact that he's doing that now in his 90s,
yeah.
I think, you know, we hear so much about young talent, but it allows older talent to be just as free. And to me, I find that even more gratifying.
Yeah, and this idea of autonomy, right, which is it's so important, and there's so much science that backs this up, right, that it makes you happier, and then you're more productive, and you do better, and we know this, like, you know, shows and scripts get noted to death, and then it starts to become art by committee, which is never good. And if you look at all our great comedies, you know, it's interesting looking at the arc of careers, right? You're almost always in comedy having this brilliance come out at the beginning, and then there's always that inevitable watering down that happens when suddenly the budgets are so big that the stuff gets, you know, noted to death by producers, unless you have enough power to just do it on your own.
Right, which is extremely rare. But, yeah, the best comedy has always been executive free, whether it was Monty Python, early SNL, The Simpsons, Mr. Show. All that is – the genius is only going to come out when you are allowed to do what you want to do creatively. And in a sense, to have creative control, it's more worthwhile. It's more powerful. It's worth more, I think, than money, in a sense, because no one gets into this to make a lot of money. They get into it to be creative. And to have that control now, it's an amazing thing.
Yep. So, Mike, one question that we ask of our guests every week is, do they have a story, a yes and story in their life, some point in their work or their life where they could have said no, but they said yes and?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I always try to say yes, because I've been through years of no one asking me anything, whether to write anything or to do anything. But my answer is that this happened very recently. I put a joke on Twitter about my OCD, mm-hmm. how living in the city is dangerous to me, because my specific tic now is turning around and looking at strangers in the eye, which nearly got me beat up a few times. So a friend of mine who's an editor at New York Times asked if I'd be interested in writing about it. And the title he came up with, the potential title, is OCD in NYC, which I thought was very funny.
Yeah.
So I thought, no, I don't want to do that, because I had never written about myself that personally before. But I was thinking, and I thought, you know, how lonely it was to be a kid, even a young adult with OCD, and not knowing what it was. So I did end up saying yes, and I did write it, and it was very cathartic. Now, I don't know if it's going to be a positive experience. It comes out this weekend. But I think just the fact that I did it makes me feel better, in that, you know, a lot of people, including family members, are going to be reading this and just reading about this for the first time. They don't know that this is my cross to bear. But I think that already I feel more free, and I am happy that I said yes.
Oh, that's awesome. There's a really terrific book. I don't know if you've read My Age of Anxiety by Scott Stossel.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. We got into a lot of conversations with Scott, and that was a similar thing with him, where these people he was working with at The Atlantic had no idea of the severity of his social anxiety.
Incredible. I mean, that book I never forgot, with specifically when the fear of vomiting and taking the Ipecac and then not vomiting. But the nurse ended up vomiting because she was so disgusted by it. I thought that was such a brave thing to do.
Absolutely.
I loved him for that. And that definitely did come to mind when I wrote about this. I think by talking about it can only help yourself and others in the situation. So hopefully I'll look back and think it's a positive thing. Now, with that said, the 1 million people who are going to read the New York Times and potentially this piece have not done so yet. That'll come this weekend. So maybe we can check back to see if everything turned okay.
Absolutely. Mike Sacks, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks. Fun.
You can find all things Mike Sacks at MikeSacks.com. Check out his podcast, buy his books. See you next week on Getting to Yes And. This is Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. You can find us at WGNplus.com. You can stream us on the WGN Plus app, or you can find us on iTunes. See you next week.